Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare and science in the news, and answers to your questions via email or phone. And I'll be giving out those phone numbers in just a moment. But before I do that, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of its staff, its contributors, or anyone else involved. Just us. So, the other thing to tell you is that the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for professional consultation. I'll be giving out the phone numbers in just a moment, but I wanted to start out with a few interesting science stories in the news. The first important news for patients on dialysis. There are 350,000 people in the United States on dialysis. Dialysis removes toxins from the blood when the kidneys have failed and can no longer do so. But the devil's in the details, and contact with the polymers in the tubing and the filters activate the immune system via a cascade of compounds called the complement cascade. And this causes substantial inflammation in people every time they have dialysis. And since most individuals undergo this three times a week, there's a substantial increase in inflammation, which is associated to a much higher risk of death from coronary artery disease. And in fact, your life expectancy, five-year survival on dialysis is only 35%. In other words, two-thirds of people don't make it 5 years if they stay on dialysis. Well, those are pretty dismal odds, and we'd like to be able to do something about that. Researchers have been trying to find a component that would block the most important complement aspect that's being activated. This is called C3. This is at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, and they have a candidate compound that they call CP40. It's a small peptide, but it inhibits complement activation in animals, and they're testing this in primates in order to get a decent mimic of the human complement cascade. The lovely thing about this agent is that it's very short acting, so it could be given as an injection. The person could undergo their dialysis, and then it would wear off, and they would have a normal immune system and a normal complement cascade in order to fight off infection for the next few days, and then briefly could be turned off again. So stay tuned for that. But for people on dialysis, that may be coming to a dialysis center near you. Our second article is a heads up for infertility. This is male infertility. And a study of more than 9,000 men with fertility problems has revealed that there is a substantial risk to being infertile to your own health as a man. In fact, men who have reproductive difficulties have a much higher risk for hypertension and cardiovascular disease. This study was done in a fairly young group of men. Let's see, these were between 30 and 50 years old, average age was 38, who went through the Stanford Hospital infertility clinics between 1994 and 2011. So, of the men who had infertility due to poor semen quality, there were markedly higher rates of hypertension, vascular disease, and heart disease developing over the subsequent years in this man's life. So there is, perhaps poor semen is an early warning marker for things going on in the body. Anyway, I think higher surveillance might be indicated in individuals with male infertility in the light of these findings. Our last story for the intro, anyway, is about, well, genes load the gun and environment pulls the trigger. You've heard me say that before. This article about genetic variation in neurotransmitters shows that there are certain DNA variations commonly found in the population that seem to predispose to antisocial and delinquent behavior. But the circumstances make a huge difference. The three genes we're talking about were studied in Sweden. The one county invited all of their high school students between 17 and 18 to participate, and they ended up with roughly 1,300 takers. And they completed anonymous questionnaires looking at delinquency, family conflict, experiences of sexual and physical abuse, and the quality of their relationship with their parents. And they basically licked the postage stamp. They provided a sample of DNA from a cheek swab, and the researchers extracted the DNA. They then looked at variation of three genes. The first, monoamine oxidase, is a gene that breaks down the neurotransmitters, especially serotonin. What they found was that those men who had a less active variation of MAOA, this was about 25% of the cohort, those who experienced physical abuse in childhood were much more likely than those who were not abused to display antisocial behavior, whereas abuse and neglect in childhood did not carry a increased risk of antisocial behavior in the 75% of the men who had the normal variant, the more active MAOA. Oddly enough, on females, it was exactly the opposite. Females with the high variation of the MAOG gene were the ones who seemed to have antisocial behavior triggered by abuse in childhood. Another gene they looked at is brain-derived neurotrophic factor. This modulates genetic and neuronal plasticity. Those who had low levels of expression of BDNF, which was about 30% of individuals, this variant is associated with aggressive behavior if in childhood you were exposed to aggressive peers and bullying. So this low activity variation really did seem to carry, in the study that was done, an increased risk of this behavior. The last one they looked at was HTTLPR, a serotonin transporter. And this one, again, if you had the low activity variant, high aggressive behavior. In other words, if you were exposed to it, you picked it up and you ran with it. So what this means, and follow-up studies showed, was that the level of good relationship with a parent was a significant mitigating factor. So the people who really had the risk for the aggressive behavior were those who did not have a strong bond with at least one of their parents. And indeed, all of the studies that we're looking at genetics are risk factors. They are not destiny. And good parenting, a solid, loving relationship with other human beings makes a huge difference in what this DNA does. So the take-home lesson here is really love thy neighbor and especially love the children. I'm going to go to our first email, and this one from CK in Bonanza, Oregon. Love that, Bonanza, Oregon. Chest pain. I am a 52-year-old, 5'7", 118-pound, no health issue, no medications, no history of heart issues, 30 years a vegetarian. And you know where this is going, right? I've done everything right, but... So, winter 2014, I was training for walking a half marathon. I completed the event in May. 1 week later, I was in the ER with chest pain, pressure, then pain in my jaw and shoulders. The only unusual sign was a heart rate of 42. Normal resting for me is 58. All vitals showed a healthy adult. An overnight stay in the hospital showed increasing enzyme evidence of a cardiac event. I had every non-invasive test known to the local cardiologist, all showed a healthy heart and body. Though the cardiologist would not say I had had a myocardial infarction, subsequent medical records say I have had a non-QA MI. Parenthetically, I want to point out that when you have something at a hospital, they have to come up with a code so they can get paid. And often your diagnosis may be we're not sure what you had, but we are sure that we want to get paid, so we're going to pick non-Q-wave MI to justify that hospital stay. Anyway, back to the letter. Since May, I've had a feeling of bruising along the outside of my left breast and lung. Not really painful, just not normal, sort of aching bruised. The cardiologist and my GP are at a loss. Just yesterday, a friend of me told her her daughter-in-law experienced a spontaneous coronary arterial dissection 3 weeks after giving birth to her second child. My friend did not know about my episode in May, and when I described it to her, she asked me to please seek other medical advice. In her mind, my unexplained cardiac event fits many of what her family had learned about SCAD since her daughter-in-law's series of heart attacks. She had two within 24 hours. So my question is, what else can cause a healthy, non-smoking, limited drinking, active person to have a cardiac event that the most common test cannot detect? Could it be SCAD, hypothyroid, undetected sleep apnea, all none? I want to address whatever health issue I have, but my local, admittedly rural, healthcare providers do not know what was up with me, and I am just going to keep searching. Can you help? Either way, thanks for taking the time to read this story. So, first of all, 2CK, I'm not sure whether non-invasive means that you, I think it means you probably did not have an angiogram, and that would be absolutely the first place to go if that was not done. In terms of other things to check, high sensitivity C-reactive protein, and also look at your 125 vitamin D level as a marker for inflammation. Congenital abnormalities can occur, and structural versus infectious. Blood clots are, small blood clots are a common source of small heart disease, and it's not entirely clear really whether you had a heart attack, but you did have some sort of problem cardiac-wise interfering with blood flow enough to kill some cells or at least cause them to leak troponin, which is the enzyme that they are talking about. Now, let's talk a little bit about SCAD, because this is a fairly rare event, less than 0.1% of angiograms will turn this up. It commonly occurs, it's rare, let's start with that, and it's especially rare because it occurs in premenopausal women. In fact, a third of the cases occur immediately around the time of delivering a baby, probably due to the hormonal effects on the blood vessel wall. And also the hormonal effects of giving birth are that your tissues become stretchy, particularly your elastin and your collagen. And in spontaneous coronary arterial dissection, what happens is you get a run in your stocking. You get a tiny little hole, a tear in the blood vessel wall, and the blood gets under that tear and lifts up the blood vessel wall, creating a blockage. If this occurs in a major artery, it can be fatal, and in fact, sudden death for that reason. A lot of these are found post-mortem when a healthy woman dies suddenly. People who have Marfan's disease, type 4 Ehlers-Danlos, which are both collagen defects that make your body tissue more likely to stretch and tear, are also subject to this. So, yes, you might have this, but if you had Marfan's or Ehlers-Danlos, you'd have other physiologic findings, long, thin fingers, extreme hyperflexibility, and realistically, at 52, you'd be an outlier for SCAD because you'd be rather old. The only way they ever find this is by angiogram. So I think that's what you need, really. And the possibility, the low-grade pain you're having, if it is non-exertional, I think that it would worry me less. But I still think you should have an angiogram, CK, and I hope you'll go forward leaving the wonderful and no doubt fabulous Bonanza, Oregon, and heading for a major urban center where this more advanced testing can be done. I think you need a tertiary med center. And our next email from Wendy. Blood sugar levels, and this is Wendy in Santa Cruz, pancreatic cancer family history. Dr. Don, both of my parents died of pancreatic cancer, as well as my maternal uncle, and my brother and first cousin both have diabetes. My blood sugar levels are slightly elevated and trending upwards. 6 months ago, my doctor recommended reducing carbohydrates and sugar and exercise, although I already eat pretty well and am a very active person. My problem is that I'm losing weight and really cannot afford to, being now 115 pounds at 5'7". I would like nutrition advice and other suggestions. So, first of all, Wendy, when people have diabetes in their family, and you have a strong family history of, I'm assuming, type 2 diabetes, it would be important to change your diet and stop simple carbohydrates. But I want to also throw out, and it's a little bit of a head ghost, and I apologize for this, but with two family members dying of pancreatic cancer, I think you need very, very careful surveillance there. And you should, now that you're showing signs of diabetes, it's particularly imperative that you get your pancreas imaged by, at a minimum, an MRI with contrast. You really need to take a critical look at that pancreas and see if indeed there are any mysterious growths on it, because recent research has shown a strong correlation between the development of diabetes in lean individuals and later development of pancreatic cancer. Possibly the disease of the pancreas itself is hereditary. We don't really know, but the pancreatic cancer correlation with this mysterious type of diabetes really, really should prompt an investigation. And, you know, you may have to really push, but I would encourage you to do so to try to get that pancreas imaged. Early pancreatic cancer is curable, but early is key. You have to find it while it's still small and resectable, and in general, it's completely asymptomatic at that stage. So this early diabetes is something to check for. People of Asian or South, basically Asian, Chinese, Japanese, Southeast Asian, and also South Asian, as in India, Pakistan, when they come to the United States, the first and second generations often develop diabetes even though they're not overweight. And this has to do with the fact that they're epigenetically modified to survive on one kind of diet, and then they come here and they have a much more calorie-dense diet. Switching away to protein and vegetables is great, but what you need to do to avoid further weight loss is to add in healthy fats. Try using extra coconut oil, walnut oil, avocados, and non-peanut nut butters, and see if you can add these to your diet. You may need, because your pancreas sounds like it's a little iffy, you may need to use digestive enzymes in addition orally to be able to tolerate these, but it is important not to have too much further weight loss. I would also emphasize protein supplements and resistance exercise, trying to build muscle. That will help with the insulin receptors. It would be worthwhile to get testing for a glucose challenge and look at your insulin levels. Look how high they go when you're confronted with a glucose challenge physiologically. This will help in deciding whether this is whether the issue is primarily with the pancreas not being able to put out enough insulin, or whether or not you are developing peripheral insulin resistance, and that will help guide therapy. Our next email from Susan in Capitola, microscopic colitis. I've just been diagnosed with microscopic colitis from biopsies taken during a colonoscopy. My symptom has been chronic diarrhea for 6 months. My doctor wants me to take Pepto-Bismol 4 times a day for 4 months. Can you recommend a natural alternative to Pepto-Bismol? Well, yes, Susan, I can, but I want to emphasize bismuth subsalicylate, which is what's in Pepto-Bismol, is actually a fairly natural compound. It's, you know, a mineral, and I wouldn't really view this at the same level as a pharmaceutical. But that being said, you do get a fair amount of aspirin off of Pepto-Bismol, and taking it 4 times a day will definitely push your salicylate levels up. So I can understand you're wanting to avoid it. The way that I would first approach this is something called the 4R protocol or heuristic in functional medicine. And we think in terms of, first of all, getting rid of things that could be driving inflammation. This could represent food sensitivities. I'd be particularly worried about gluten as a factor here. And you certainly should have good celiac testing. My recommendation there is the anti-deaminated gliadin, tissue transglutaminase, IgA, and IgG. And if those are all negative, then you have an 85% chance of not having a gluten-related problem. But because of what we have done to our food supply and the issues I talked about last week with actually spraying Roundup on all wheat to increase crop yield, just craziness, we really are putting things into our body that look like good quality food, but are actually potentially toxic. Microorganisms, parasites, dysbiosis, a bad microbiome, these things can definitely contribute to inflammation and help drive a colitis. Other issue is, so an elimination diet, I think, and also perhaps testing for microorganisms with a functional medicine doctor would be first things to do. The second R stands for replace, and this means replenishing the nutrients that might be deficient and helping support the cell wall functioning. We use doses of vitamin D, omega-3 fatty acids, zinc, and other compounds to replace these things that might be lacking. Then it's restore. And when we, what we're trying to do there is support the production of a healthy wall. And because you have microscopic colitis, it's really important for you to have high levels of short chain fatty acids. These are things that are broken down by your good bacteria when you eat fiber. So good soluble fiber, maybe ghee, which is a clarified butter. It contains high levels of butyrate, which is one of these short chain fatty acids. It's very soothing and healing. And it actually is the fuel supply for the colon cells. So if you're trying to heal raw ulcerated colon, you want a lot of butyrate and short chain fatty acids in there. And you can help that by actually eating clarified butter. So that would be something else I'd recommend. Reinoculating, and this is where we talk about getting a good, healthy microbiome. And that means, first of all, checking to see that you don't need to take some kind of antibacterial to get rid of something that shouldn't be there, but then also giving back relatively high levels, I'm saying 25 to 100 billion, depending upon what else is going on in your system, of a mixed variety of probiotics trying to support that healthy microbiome. So microscopic colitis doesn't just come out of the blue. It isn't something like the colitis fairy comes along and points her stick at you. There's a reason that you developed that, and that reason is lurking somewhere in the topics I've just covered. So good luck, and I hope this has been helpful for you. Here's a little tidbit about penicillin allergy. Many people have been told that they are allergic to penicillin because they had a rash when they took amoxicillin or for some other reason. And often other antibiotics are used, but they are more toxic, more expensive, and often less effective. Two studies were recently done by the American College of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. They looked at people who believed they had penicillin allergy. And then they tested them using standard allergy testing prior to surgery. In the first study, there were 384 people who gave a history of penicillin allergy. But when they were tested by the gold standard therapy, 94% of them actually were not penicillin allergic. This other study, only 38 people in this, but similar results. They did penicillin skin testing to see if people were really allergic. And indeed, most of them were. In fact, of the 38, all of them were. And so maybe you're not actually penicillin allergic. Certainly, if you are fighting off an illness or needing recurrent antibiotics, let's say, for example, that you have a heart valve problem that requires antibiotics every time you get your teeth cleaned, it would definitely be worthwhile to get skin tested for penicillin, because if you can take penicillin for your dental prophylaxis, that's much easier on your microbiome, which more and more we're coming to see is a really key player in our general health. Well, we come up to the top of the hour, and I think I'm going, the halfway part, I should say the bottom of the hour, I guess, at least if you're thinking about an old analog clock. Some new devices and some thoughts about the latest and greatest device just being announced at the Heart Failure Society of America. This is a phase 3 trial of something called the CardioMEMS system. We've talked about the quantified self-movement and people wearing their Fitbits and things to see how many exercise steps. This, and I've been saying for a few years that implantable devices are just a heartbeat away. Well, indeed, here they are. The CardioMEMS is implanted into the pulmonary artery, and it is a wireless device that talks to your pillow. Here's how it works. A person who has a history of congestive heart failure has this device implanted, and then every day when they lie down on a special pillow that talks to the device for 20 seconds and then transmits the pulmonary artery pressure readings to an internet website. If the readings fall outside of the target range, an email notification is automatically sent to the patient's healthcare provider. Once the office receives the message, a nurse, practitioner, or a physician's assistant phones the patient and adjusts the medications according to a protocol based on scripted questions. So, no doctor's hand needs to touch this. This is automating a process. You can call in and tell me what you think about this. As a doctor, I'm a little bit skeptical about, but I guess all of us can be automated out of existence sooner or later by expert systems. At least that's what some people think. Anyway, this is billable by Medicare, apparently, to Medicare, apparently, which was a lot of the questions were in the audience were about whether we could get paid for this monitoring, because obviously there's overhead involved. And what the study showed that with patients with class 2 or class 3 heart failure, they cut the readmission rate quite a bit, from 25% readmission rate over 30 days to 18%. They got measurements 6 out of the 7 days, so patient compliance was pretty good. And in people with heart failure, I think I'll put this out there right now, what gets you is the salt load. So it's holiday season and you're going to parties and there are buffets and there is macaroni and what were some of the things I saw last night at a party that people shouldn't eat if they have heart failure? Macaroni and cheese, a really excellent vegetarian chili, hot dogs, sausages, cheese. Well, let's see. Was there anything that a person with heart failure should have eaten at that party last night? Ah, yes, the salad. But here's the point. It's weight gain over several days to a week before the heart decompensates. So you don't need an implantable pulmonary artery device. What you basically need is to get on the scale every morning. And if you start putting on a pound a day, You're taking on water, friends, and it's time to call your doctor, because a little water pill, a little diuretic early on will derail the decompensation of the heart failure. And just getting people to check their blood pressure and get on a scale every morning, that's not that hard. If you could just get people to do that, you wouldn't need to do this implantable stuff and put people to the risk of sticking something in their pulmonary artery. That's not exactly minimally invasive. We'd be able to do it with just a little personal self-discipline and a good relationship with our primary care provider. So watch the salt, lesson one. Number one there, watch the salt, please. And number two, weigh yourself daily. And number three, the brave new world of implantable devices is on our doorstep. Not quite yet FDA approved, but given the way this class, the money they're saving by spending this money is enough to justify these invasive devices. And once Medicare approves it, OMG, everyone's going to want to do it, because, hey, they get a great fee for implanting the device, And yes, it does prevent readmissions. So it's a win-win for everybody. I hope you heard the irony. We're going now to Carrie in Aptos. Hello, Carrie. Welcome to the program.
I am going to ask a question and get off the line because my phone drops calls. But I was listening this morning. It seems like you've mentioned inflammation a couple of times this morning, one in relation to vitamin D.
Yes, I have.
And could you just talk a little more about inflammation in the body and how, what it's doing and you know, it seems to be really damaging, but how would I get a hold on that and find out anything? I need to know more about what it's doing in the body and what I need to do.
Well, you know, thank you, Carrie, and I'll go ahead and take you off the air. Thank you for the question. Bye-bye. Okay, so inflammation. Well, let's start with when I was in medical school, and they gave me this book list, and I went out and bought those books, and there's this 3.5-inch thick, maybe 4-inch thick book called Robbins and Cotran's Pathologic Basis of Disease. And so the syllabus said, you know, read chapter one. So I sat down and chapter one, all about inflammation. And inflammation is, well, it's kind of the controlled burn, right? If you've got a forest, you need to do a controlled burn. Fires are good for a forest when they're limited. They burn off all of the debris. They help the seeds germinate. Lots of plants can't even survive without a little bit of burning now and then. And of course, the plants in the forest have frequent small fires. They're happy. Giant big fires destroy the forest. And we've learned that, and now they do control burns, and mostly that works. It's a great metaphor for what's going on with inflammation. We need inflammation to kill bacteria and to help our response to injury. In other words, inflammation is like sending a smoke signal to some other aspect of our body saying, come and help. And those helper cells and helper compounds that they release ultimately lead to the breakdown of damaged tissue, the destruction of viruses and bacteria, and the renewal of that area through the activation of fibroblasts and other body cells that heal and restore the tissue. So it's a balance between breakdown and buildup. And when it works beautifully, but it can get out of hand. And there are often issues with not enough inflammation, which leads to immunosuppression, and lack of degradation of garbage, you know, that accumulates in our cells, and too much inflammation, which leads to breakdown, damage, and cancer, as well as the deposition of coronary artery plaque. And being overly inflamed is pretty much synonymous with all of the old age diseases that you can think of. So everything from cataracts to hypertension to heart attacks to strokes to dementia, Parkinson's disease, arthritis. These are all cases of too much inflammation. So keeping that balanced is key. Now, one of the drivers of too much inflammation that exists in modern society is the modifications of the diets that has been made through agriculture. And we now use, because we have industrial processing of food, we're able to pull oils out of seeds and out of corn and places like that, where go back 500 years, most of the oils that were used were coming from animal fat and things like olives and not from these hard seeds, which you can't really extract fat from until you have hydraulic presses. So we shifted the diet, and in doing that, we've altered the ratio of omega-3 to omega-6 fatty acids that are coming into our mouths. These fatty acids are used to make the inflammatory eicosanoids, prostaglandins and leukotrienes, are chemical signals that turn on inflammation. And these subtle differences in the fatty acid backbone that's used to make these molecules makes the inflammatory signals more powerful. So it's as if you're amplifying a signal that needs to be carefully modulated. But because of our diet, we've amplified that signal excessively, leading to a kind of over-inflamed populace. And this is, you know, a big piece of degenerative disease. So anyone who's a regular listener here has heard me rant on and on and on about the value of additional omega-3 fatty acids in the diet. And, you know, there's tons of dietary studies showing that as little as 3 servings of fatty fish a week has a substantial effect on heart attacks. Now, that's kind of amazing. And so I am a very strong advocate for the use of supplementary omega-3s just for everybody. I think everyone can benefit from a couple thousand milligrams of that. And of course, there are situations like when you're going into surgery where you may want to back off on your omega-3s because you kind of want your blood to clot when you're going to cut your body open. But under most circumstances, you really don't want your blood to clot too readily because that's how heart attacks and strokes happen. So I think one more thing on inflammation is that there are food sources of compounds that are profound anti-inflammatories. And one of the best ones out there is turmeric, curcumin, which is found in turmeric, which is a common spice. This particular compound modulates the production of these inflammatory compounds I was talking about and prevents them from being upregulated. So in other words, when there's an injury, there's a cascade of events that leads to the production of more messenger RNA to make prostaglandins. And if you block that upregulation by the use of curcumin, then the over-response to the signal that is kind of endemic because of our diet is mitigated. So this is another thing that can be safely taken every day and appears to have, at least in the story so far, substantial health benefits. And let's go now to Carol in Santa Cruz. Hello, Carol. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
I got insurance for the first time with the Affordable Health Care Act, and I finally acted on it and thought, well, I'll just get a doctor and get a physical, and I got a blood workup done, and when I went in for the follow-up after getting all the tests, the doctor didn't have the results, but she said they were fine. So later on, I asked for the results of the blood test, and I'm just going through, and it shows the reference range and what my counts were, and I was just really curious off the reference to it. Basically, my HDL and my LDL.
Okay.
Reference points.
Right. Okay. Let's talk first of all about reference ranges, because you've got a battery of 30 tests, right? And
right.
Some of those reference ranges are based on, they're not all based on the same thing. Now, they used to be just a bell curve of, you know, go out, draw blood on 1,000 people, take the top 5% and the bottom 5%, 2.5% on the top, 2.5% off the bottom. Those are the outliers. Everybody in between is healthy, because these are 1,000 people who have no known disease. And we just figure, okay, there's a range of variation in the population, probably genetic, dietary, et cetera. So we're going to take that mid-range and call that healthy. And over time, we've modified that because we realize that a lot of the people out there who are supposedly healthy are just pre-sick. And so we have, for example, with the lipids, particularly with the cholesterols, people have gone down the rabbit hole with these, trying to find, you know, the perfect predictive markers for risk factors. And we have focused on cholesterol excessively. So I don't want to be codependent here and, you know, increase this hyper-focus on cholesterol, because really it's about inflammation. Heart disease is generated by inflammation. Only inflamed arteries rupture. And so therefore, if you have low inflammation and high cholesterol, your risk is probably not substantial. I just want to put that out there before we dive into your HDL and LDL.
So, and then what would be indicating inflammation?
HSCRP, high sensitivity C-reactive protein, is a good screen for that. I don't know if your doctor got that test on you. I get it routinely every patient, every physical, because if there's inflammation, I need to chase it down, figure out where it's coming from, and work to mitigate it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you look at people with psoriasis, people with gum disease, you pick it, people with diabetes, you pick your inflammatory thing, because insulin's really inflammatory. They all have higher rates of stroke and heart attack because the inflammation drives that. So without getting into the mechanism, which we've covered a gazillion times here on the program, if you're a woman, you want it, the best indicator is you take your total cholesterol and you divide that by your HDL, and you want that number under 5, but you really, as a woman, you deserve to have it under 4, just on the basis of the effect that being female has on your HDL. If you came up snake eyes in the genetic crapshoot, you may, after menopause, lose your good HDL. And so I always recheck women after menopause to see if their HDL plummets. And in about 10% of them, it does. And those are the women that are really at high risk for heart disease in the 10 years after menopause. So that's one subgroup. So you want that total cholesterol divided by that HDL to be 3.5, ideally. I mean, that or lower is the goal for being healthy and safe. That has the best predictive value for women. The problem is they don't differentiate males and females on these cholesterol studies, and yet we know from the science that there's huge differences. What happened was that historically we focused on cholesterol, and then that wasn't working well as a predictor. So then we focused on LDL, which is the low-density lipoprotein cholesterol, which is a direct, it does have direct implications, but really when it's super high. So, for example, if you've got an LDL of 190, mm-hmm. you've got trouble, and you really do want to address that, because even at normal levels of inflammation, that could be a problem. And then it gets more complicated. The size of the LDL particle matters, and most likely your doctor just did a regular lipid panel, and when you look next to the LDL, it says LDL calculated. And what they don't measure it directly, they use a nomogram, and that works unless you're an outlier. So if your LDL is your LDL above 160?
No.
Okay, so you're in that sort of, it's flagged, but it's not, but you're like, okay, well, what do I do about this? And the fact is, with the way they're doing this testing now, just about half of the people who get tested get flagged as abnormal or high risk. And we're over-identifying at this point and scaring people and maybe not focusing on the right thing anyway, in my opinion. What was your HDL?
Not evident to me. I'm not sure.
All right, honey. Don't worry about it.
Okay, but I see the ratio, but I don't see... Oh, cholesterol HDL?
Yeah.
102.
Okay. That's a really high number. High is good, by the way. And so I would get the inflammatory checked and make sure that that's low. And let me ask you, is there something that says like pattern A or pattern B there on your thing? It will be...
No.
Okay, so that means they didn't measure particle size, and in your case with that HDL, I probably wouldn't do any follow-up testing because that's fairly protective.
Okay.
Okay?
All right.
So let me just say one last thing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you exercise?
On my bike, going from point A to point B around town or surfing once in a while.
Okay. Try to get 20 minutes... of moderate exercise every day. It'll add years to your life, and it's not that hard.
Okay.
Okay?
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Now we're going to go to John in Santa Cruz. Hello, John. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I wanted to ask your views, and I think you probably have heard of this, of the possibility of a 3-day fasting before chemo in order to try to reboot the immune system. There's a researcher, Dr. Walter Longo, who's done research on the beneficial effects, you know, the idea being that normal cells will be stressed in a sort of a life-or-death situation and become more resilient and adaptive, whereas cancer cells will be segregated and sensitized and exposed to the chemo, and that, you know, you also supposedly will reduce the ill effects of the chemo by doing the fasting first. But then, the question always is, it's complicated, you know, if you're fasting in winter, or is this really not a propitious time? Are you going to... Well, anyways, I'm just wondering if you have views on this, because I know you understand acupuncture and the Chinese view, mm-hmm. and probably have heard of this concept.
I have heard of the concept, and I'm waiting for... Well, I'm concerned about a couple of things that would be hard to watch out for, but let's just go to some basic physiology. Cancer cells generally lose the ability to live off fat. When you fast, what you do is you live off of your fat. So you start, first you burn through some your protein, you start catabolizing protein and turning protein into glucose, but you also start burning fat, because when you fast, there's no insulin.
Right.
So your fat burning turns on, and you make these things called ketone bodies,
right.
And you've probably heard of the ketogenic diet, and it's
right.
essentially a diet that doesn't have any starch in it.
Right.
And then when you start burning ketone bodies, that's your cells are a bit more stressed. It changes what the mitochondria are doing. That mitochondrial stress actually leads to mitochondrial cell division, and we think, particularly in the brain, that may contribute to the long-term health of the neurons. So fasting is probably good at many levels for you, and the cool thing is that cancer cells can't live on ketones. They
right.
mostly don't. They mostly need that sugar. So these would be, you know, strong reasons to consider a ketogenic diet while you're doing chemotherapy. And I think that that might, you know, be an effective alternative for those who can't fast to still achieve this effect. What worries me about fasting is the toxic effect of the chemotherapy is actually going to be magnified, because your liver is not going to be able to process the chemo drug nearly as well 3 days out, because you'll be missing a lot of these very important cofactors that sulfate, glycine, glucuronate. These are things that you need, and they are used up fairly quickly, and they come in through the diet. And so I would be more inclined to say, if you're going to fast, make it a juice fast and do like vegetable juices, so that you're getting some of the compounds like, you know, onions and tomatoes and cucumbers and leeks and things like that. Maybe broth if you wanted to, or bone broth with some protein in it. I don't think that's going to undercut the benefits of the fast, but it is going to give you those cofactors that will help you protect your cells internally from the adverse effects of the chemo. And so the pure fasting worries me that it's going to magnify the toxicity.
Yeah, that's interesting, because these people, you know, taking this line of approach didn't, you know, they've done small clinical trials in humans, which seem to be promising, but I don't think they've done extensive, you know, and it's mostly laboratory tests with animals, and, you know, it seemed to be a good idea. But what you bring up about the liver and toxicity seems an obvious objection that they ought to have addressed. I haven't seen it addressed directly yet.
I haven't either, and my problem is I don't know how to measure it.
Yeah.
So if you can't measure it and it's invisible,
They claim that the ordinary symptoms of chemo in these small trials are reduced, you know, the headaches and some of the body responses. Now, you would think that with liver toxicity, that would be expressed, and yet they're claiming that overall your actual physical responses mm-hmm. to chemo are diminished.
Right, and there's currently a big NIH trial going on this, and, you know, it's in progress, so we don't know yet. It's an intriguing idea, and so what I think of it now is, yeah, it's an intriguing idea. I would probably hedge my bets with maybe a ketogenic diet, or if you really want to, you know, calorie stress everything, then I'd probably do you know, fruit, vegetable, you know, don't forget the fruits because that has sugar in it, and just use vegetable juicing as a way to make sure that you've got the cofactors.
Right. That sounds fun. So it might be a good idea to, you know, it's funny because the whole drift of this guy's studies were sort of prolonged fat, you know, stress, excess fasting, you know, three-day fasting versus caloric reduction approaches. And he was trying to demonstrate caloric reduction doesn't really do that much for you. But from what you're saying, it sounds to me like keeping on a sort of a ketogenic withdrawal of starches throughout the chemo period would probably be beneficial.
Yeah, this is kind of how I advise people to go, is just if they can, you have to maintain your weight. And so you don't want to be losing a ton of weight. For one thing, when you lose weight, you dump lead, mercury, dioxin, DDT, PCBs into your bloodstream, and you know, which is like, here's the liver, you know, trying to detoxify all this chemo stuff, and you throw all this other crap at it. It's like, oh my God, this is so. You want to maintain a weight, and more healthy fat is a way to do it. Plus, it isn't something the cancer cells can eat. When my father was dying of cancer, they told him to eat ice cream if that's all he wanted to eat. And at the time, you know, he was losing weight so terribly. This was way before I studied functional medicine. Now I think about that advice that he was given by his very well-meaning doctors, and I just cringe.
Yeah.
Because it was feeding his cancer.
Right. So you want to reduce the sugars and the starches, but you want to keep up the good fats and lean protein and the vegetables.
Exactly.
Right.
Feed the cells stuff they can eat. The cells are omnivorous,
right.
But the cancer cells are pretty much obligate glucose users.
Yeah. Well, this is an interesting. You know, it's interesting to be at this kind of theoretical crux where the NIH is doing an extended study. You don't completely have the answers, and yet your life situation is plunging into a place where you really actually do need to make decisions about what to do. And I think this ketogenic approach that you've outlined makes sense as a pretty good hedge.
Another thing I would urge you to do is go Google IV vitamin C in cancer.
Okay.
Because there's, I think, good data. It's old data, and we somehow, if it isn't newly published on the internet, it somehow isn't real. But there's good old data that I think holds up quite well to scrutiny, that if you give intravenous vitamin C, and it has to be IV because you need to get a big spike in the bloodstream, that spike causes an oxidative burst. In other words, even though vitamin C is an antioxidant, it's one of these paradoxical effects. You get a surge of oxidative stress inside the cells, and this is at the time that you're hitting with the chemo, and it really delivers a 1-2 punch to the cancer cells.
Wow.
And so,
would you try to do an injection just before each chemo treatment or something?
Right, just before or just after. Concurrently was what as close to concurrently as you can manage.
Who can do that? Can an ordinary physician give that kind of
an idea? Ordinary physician can. There's several physicians in town who do IV vitamin C infusions. It's not standard of care medicine, and you're going to need to go and pull those articles and bring them in and talk to your oncologist about it. What happened with vitamin C therapy is that I believe it was Mayo Clinic did a oral vitamin C in cancer study, which showed it didn't work, and everybody said, oh, well, it doesn't work. But they didn't really replicate the original trials. They did some. It's a very classic thing that I see all the time with nutritional medicine, is that somebody will do a big study that like kind of is preemptive, but what they did was they didn't do it right. They did a big study with the wrong dose or the wrong therapy, and then the headline says acupuncture doesn't work for X, but it's like, well, you look at their protocol, and I'm like, well, why would you do that protocol? Because you want it to fail. No, I don't think the conspiracy thing is in, but there are people who do, but I really think conspiracy theories are largely overblown. Thank you for the call.
Okay, yeah, thank you for so much. This was just the answer I was looking for, and I felt very fortunate to call and not find a huge queue. That was my concern.
Yes.
This is the exact time. I've been having these discussions all morning. I'll call and see if she's available, and by God, it was.
It was a slow phone morning just for you.
Thank you so much.
All right, you have a good day.
Okay, bye-bye.
And this is a really important safety factor, I think. There's a lot of people out there with chronic pain who are taking daily narcotics. Sometimes people are coming home from the hospital on fairly high doses of opiates, and the family members and the patients are having to try to get used to managing this. Plus, when you give things orally, it isn't quite the same as by injection, and sometimes you can inadvertently overdose. There's a new product out there, which is a handheld injector for naloxone. It's like an EpiPen, the epinephrine pens that we give out to people who have bee sting allergies, so that if they start to go into anaphylaxis, they can give themselves a life-saving injection of epinephrine. Well, naloxone is just as important, and this injector for family members who might come upon someone who is barely breathing or who's can't be awakened because they've accidentally taken an overdose, this could be a life-or-death thing. So having that reversal agent available to lay people is important. This device is called Evzio, E-V-Z-I-O. Doctors are able to prescribe vials of naloxone and needles, but then people need training in how to pull that up and when to use it. This is a benign agent. If you take it when you aren't overdosing on opiates, it doesn't do anything. So just like having those automated external defibrillators in the airport, having public having access to naloxone at home, I think, is something that we need to do. We have a lot of people dying unnecessarily from accidental opiate overdose, and just trying to restrict opiates and make it harder to write triplicates is not going to fix that. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this program as much as I have. And I hope you'll be back next week. This is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.